Final presentation, Lisa Hooper, media and music and media librarian at Tulane University in beautiful New Orleans, will present. There's the title. Yes. So I'll let her start.
Yes, now that was like the most perfect presentation to fall right before my presentation, but it's also one of the worst because that was really entertaining. I'm afraid this is going to be comparatively really, really boring. So I apologize for that. Take a nap. That's okay. I won't mind. I promise I won't mind. Let's begin with a question. If you were asked to describe the character and culture of New Orleans but could only use music as your descriptors, how might you possibly respond? Perhaps you would use genres. Jazz, zydeco, blues, brass band, bounce music might even figure into your description. Or maybe instead of genres, you'll name performers, such, of course, Louis Armstrong, Marsalis, Ruffins, and maybe even Lil Wayne if you're into bounce music. Let's see if this actually works today. One particular beverage that grows, that draws close ties with New Orleans describes it this way, and if this will connect, we might get to see a little clip. It seems like it does not want to connect again. I've been having trouble with my internet connections. This is a bourbon, I think, called obviously Southern Comfort. If you ever, it's working, excellent.
People often ask, what is Southern Comfort? Southern Comfort is New Orleans. The Big Easy, born on the tailwaters of the mighty Mississippi. It's a roiling cauldron of hip-hop, honky-tonk, and Cajun thunder. That flows like a 50 billion watt circuit cable straight into the Gulf. They broke the mold when they made New Orleans. And we broke the mold when we made Southern Comfort.
Okay, now, disclaimer, that was not advocacy to go out and start drinking. That was just coming from somebody who's actually a non-drinker in this room. But in case you didn't catch it around all the images of brass band and the sounds there of trumpets and all that kind of fun stuff, according to Southern Comfort, New Orleans is hip-hop, honky-tonky, and Cajun thunder. This is the norm. This is the music described and perpetuated in commercial media and further legitimated in scholarly articles and books. This is the music you'll find in our libraries and in our archives. This is the culturally and academically recognized official music of New Orleans. But there's yet much more music out there that does not figure into this popularized and academicized soundscape. Despite its peripheral existence beyond the gaze of popular media and academia, there's music equally born from the culture, people, and events of the city, and that contributes an equal share to the cultural character of New Orleans. Let's listen to a few seconds, essentially 30, of a song called Frenchie by Morning 44. I'm sorry. Sorry about that. Sort of going to fade out for us now. If you didn't hear New Orleans in that song, there's one that you just absolutely can't miss. It's very dark in content, I find, but its connection to the city is really quite obvious. Well, it's another sound clip, I think. Let's see if it'll work. There we go. Maybe. So even if you didn't understand the words they were saying, you didn't catch that they were singing about the Ninth Ward, you could still hear New Orleans in the heavy brass, jazz, blues, gospel influence, and the musical tones. and obviously just cover art from some of their sound recordings and publicity. The markings on the refrigerator, if you get yourself out of the quarter and into slightly less happy neighborhoods, you'll see that on a lot of houses still. And even some of the houses that have been restored, I think they intentionally left those markings up because they're still there from Katrina. Anyways, so perhaps they're not the same recognition as Marcellus or Little Wayne, and certainly nowhere to be seen or heard in our popular media, our sound recording collections, our libraries, our archives, or our scholarly publications. Morning 40 is nonetheless firmly ensconced in the popular underground, symbolizing, celebrating, and perpetuating a very specific New Orleans way of life. They and so many others exist beyond recorded memory, beyond the historical record, outside our legitimating pillars of popular music and academia. Collecting sound recordings for many of us is a matter of passion. Passion for intellectual content, passion for a given physical medium, and passion for a specific form of technology. We collect sound recordings to satisfy our own passions and share the content of our collections with researchers, friends, and others equally passionate about this work. In fulfilling our passion, however, we have the opportunity to make a much larger contribution to society, culture, and history, one of incredible significance that each collector must take into account. Namely, by collecting and preserving sound, we in essence create what will become an integral part of the historical record, which future researchers, historians, cultural anthropologists, musicologists, ethnomusicologists will all turn to in the process of writing our history. This is no insignificant detail. For our very preferences of genre and performer, even the physical medium of the recording have explicit inclusions and exclusions. Prone to our unavoidable personal preferences and cultural, social, and political biases, sound collectors, as do archivists and historians, open the potentiality for culturally significant yet underrepresented cross-sections of musical society to be effectively forgotten to history. Drawing from the work of musicologists, philosophers, archivists, and historians, and a few other folks out there, this paper examines how archiving and collecting practices influence history writing and the related cultural implications. We'll continue with a brief philosophy of the self-described activist archivist, relating their methodology to that of the sound collector. And then for the sake of conversation, I tend towards the terms archives and archivists, but these terms should be understood to be interchangeable with collections and collectors within the context specifically of this paper. So the postmodernists were the first to question the archive as a natural consequence of deconstructing the historical record. Foucault exposed positivity, or the modernist acceptance of a singular truth, as playing the role of what might be called a historical a priori. This historical a priori, he asserted... According to Foucault, the historical a priori is not of truths that might never be said or really given to experience, but the a priori of a history that is given, since it is that of things really said. Or in other words, the historical a priori is a discursive construction legitimizing what merely appears to be and declares it fact without looking at the underlying factors of contested or contesting stories. So while the meaning of these statements may be malleable, they do not simultaneously contest their own validity. Rather, they accept it unquestioningly as truth. Foucault positioned the archive at the apex of knowledge construction. As he noted, far from being only that which ensures that we exist in the midst of preserved discourse, it, or the archive, is that which differentiates discourses in their multiple existence and specifies them in their own duration. So for simplifying, for Foucault, discourse is an intertwining of selected statements to formulate historicity. In unraveling and isolating these discursive statements, the archive is given a privileged position, one that allows it to capture some and discard others, specifying the duration of their existence. Unlike Foucault, who looked at the archive from a bit of an angle, Derrida looked at it directly. Derrida actually brought the word archive back to the Greek archaion, or domicile of the archon, who held power. The politically powerful archon served as both the creator and protector of documents. As Derrida and similarly minded postmodernists saw it, objects become archive by means of privileged relationship to the resulting authority of the archive as place. Quoting Derrida, at the intersection of the topological and the nomological, of the place and the law, of the substrate and the authority, a scene of domiciliation becomes at once visible and invisible. So according to Derrida, then, and in keeping with his invocation of the arche, the archive as place symbolizes and bestows authority. By this very relationship of place and power, the archive itself lends its authority to documents brought into the archive while dismissing the validity of those left outside the archive. Documents accepted into the archive become authoritative and unquestioningly accurate representations of the past, whereas all other documents deemed not worthy of archival longevity by default are suspect and cannot serve as legitimate records. Ultimately, these records most often fall by the wayside of history to become lost in dusty attics until they are eventually forgotten. So we can be a bit more explicit and attempt to bring the philosophy down to practicality. Memory practices, or the practice of creating a record of an event to be retained for future reference, are often used not only by individuals taking snapshots during their New Orleans vacation trip, but they're also used by politically or socially powerful people consciously constructing a prescribed image of contemporary society. Patrick Geary noted in one of his books that Arnold of St. Emmeram compared the process of sorting through the past to the process of clearing the arable, cutting down groves once sacred to the gods so that the land could be made useful for the present. This same pruning was going on in the archives across the continent. Both he and Paul Saint-Père de Chartres emphasized that not everything was going to be preserved, only that which was useful. More insidiously, historian Mike Featherstone writes that the archive was part of the apparatus of social rule and regulation. It facilitated the governance of the territory and population through the accumulation of information. What's often forgotten in the larger interdisciplinary conversation, but not lost on archivists, is the archivist's own role in legitimizing certain documents and delegitimizing others. Archivist Rand Jimerson nicely summarized the feeling of the larger archival community in the wake of the publication of Derrida's Archive Fever. The archives is a place of knowledge, memory, nourishment, and power. Archives at once protect and preserve records, legitimize and sanctify certain documents while negating and destroying others, and provide access to selected sources while controlling the researchers and conditions under which they may examine the archival record. This led to a paradigmatic shift at almost all levels of the archival process, from collection development to description and access. So obviously here, in the context of this conference, we're focused and concerned with collecting. So relative to collecting, in 2001, Terry Cook made a call to all archivists urging them to look beyond the records brought into them and passively accepted into the archive, instead he admonished his colleagues, writing that it is no longer acceptable to limit the definition of society's memory solely to the documentary residue left over or chosen by powerful record creators. Public and historical accountability demands more of archives and archivists. So as archivists began exploring the basic principles of postmodernist philosophy, it also became apparent to them that their own social conditioning created a field of biases through which selection decisions were made. Vern Harris, a central figure in rebuilding the South African archives after the end of apartheid, is a leader in this line of thought. Harris was among the earliest in the archival profession to note the integral relationship between the record's creator and the appraising archivist. According to Harris, the appraiser's values, quality of work perspectives, interactions with the creators and owners of records, engagement with the policy he or she is implementing, and so on, all become markings in the appraisal and determine what becomes the archival record. The appraiser is a co-creator of the archival record. So taking this out of the archive proper and to the collector, the individual collector's preferences for a certain genre or even recording format play an intrinsic role in what is and is not preserved for longevity, of what is or is not available for future researchers to study and write about. Ultimately, these preferences and biases impact what is and is not a part of the historical record. In recognition of this, we can now find activist archivists such as Vern Harris working to rebuild the South African archive in a manner that fairly represents all sections of South African society, Sue McKemish, working to bring the documents of Indigenous peoples into Australian archives. Darcy Alexandra, working to create archives of immigrant populations in Ireland. And numerous archives representing LGBT organizations, workers' unions, undocumented immigrant populations, Native populations, and a host of other often underrepresented groups. Oops, let's go back. Sorry to get your hopes up. Still a few more pages. Sorry. Running in tandem with this injection of the subaltern into the archives and a new understanding of the archivist's power over historicity is a new concern for remaining relevant in musicology. Here, too, they recognize the interpretive effect of contemporary tropes on the past. Rob Wegman somewhat dramatically summarizes the influence of contemporary scholars on the past. He writes, "The pursuit of music history is driven and contaminated by the values, creative impulses, dreams, and illusions and neuroses of our time. Without the firm interpretive hand of the music historian, the massive flood of unsorted, undigested, unprocessed material that we euphemistically call historical evidence would remain devoid of any apparent sense of meaning. That material is the clay, the raw material that we are irresistibly driven to cut, shape, and mold in our image. It, or history writing, is a creative act of imposing order on chaos." So, of course, Wegman is also deceiving himself if he truly believes that the historical evidences we keep in our collections and archives are unsorted, undigested, unprocessed, or otherwise untainted by the biases inherent to archival processes. Wegman ascribes these godlike powers of interpretation to musicologists in a blatantly ironic manner, one both critical and accepting of this inherent fault of historical interpretation. So postmodernism has essentially brought musicology as a discipline to a rather uncomfortable position. How to write about the past without inscribing present-day values and biases on the past? So unlike archivists who happily still believe they fulfill their role by adopting critically aware methods of acquisition, arrangement, and description, musicologists have yet to find their way out of this quandary. Some are looking to methodological principles long since adopted by anthropologists and ethnomusicologists. So along this vein, musicologists are now advocating a critical awareness and investigation of the socio-political structures that supported any given line of musical creation. According to Gary Tomlinson, the usefulness of such a critique lies in its clearing the way for meaningful comparison of the urges to make music and modes of music making across large stretches of human history and culture. And I really can't help but pause to notice here that out of postmodernism rises yet again a desire to study music with a goal of finding some universal trend, or the modernist dream of a musical Ursprache. Of greater significance, though, to our present concern of collecting and archiving, is the impact of this methodological shift may have on the musical canon. Tomlinson himself notes that such an approach requires a relocation of these canons in the broader disciplinary and historical panorama. As the Eurocentric tendencies of historical musicology are removed, the field moves deeper into realms of study that had previously been reserved for ethnomusicology. The acknowledgement and subsequent rejection of European art music as the only legitimate music opens the musicological field to more popular forms and genres. As Bruno Nettel, Ralph Locke, Samuel Adler, and a host of other musicologists and ethnomusicologists have observed, musicology increasingly refers to the works of anthropology and ethnomusicology, while ethnomusicology increasingly refers to the works of historical musicology. This, accompanied by a new interest in the interdisciplinary deconstruction of sociopolitical structures supporting, or at the very least influencing, the creation of music, musicologists are now beginning to accept hip-hop, folk, and other popular genres as legitimate arenas for the continuation of musicological discourse. So, the canon. Not only is it experiencing a dialectical relocation, as Tomlinson noted, but it is actually being redefined as pieces of popular music are being added to the litany of significant works. As archivists, librarians, and collectors, we could just continue on as we always have been, collecting that which interests us and leaving it to the historians to believe they're the ones to mold and shape and give meaning to the historical documents. But I always wonder, is that all we actually should be doing? Should we be doing more? Collectors and archivists, as I hope I've already made clear, are in a unique position to gather the sound documents of today and yesterday, Recordings that we leave out of our collections en masse will most likely not be seen by historians, not be included as part of the historical record. Their roles of active cultural participants will be lost and will suffer from one giant sort of historical amnesia, historical and cultural amnesia as far as I'm concerned. We're at an incredibly interesting point in time with so many cultural modes of expression that are often contradicting each other. So as we build our collections in this time that we're attempting to assimilate, as soon as we negate, hang on a second, that makes no sense. As we build our collections in a time that attempts to assimilate and negate differences as soon as those differences have been celebrated, collectors need to critically re-examine their own biases and those of the popular media. We need to challenge our own conceptions of social relevance and reach towards inclusiveness rather than exclusiveness. We have the opportunity to go beyond the popularized social issues and dig deeper into the sound evidences of contesting cultures. Even if we choose to leave the writing and deeper interpreting to the musicologists and ethnomusicologists, by pursuing the most challenging and underrepresented music, we are at least allowing the possibility of its inclusion in the historical record. And you guys can all breathe a sigh of relief. This really is the end of my paper. Questions.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Before you were born, we and some of my contemporaries had knockdown, drag out arguments with archivists and librarians as to what they're selecting or deselecting to archive. Christopher Rhodes, who was the head of the British Institute of Recorded Sound for a while, one time stood up in the back of an IASA, International Association of Sound Archives meeting, and said, you know, when you talk about selection, maybe one of the fairest ways of selecting what stays or goes in an archive is an archive fire. Because it might make as much sense as to what is destroyed as to what decisions are made for selection by the archivists.
You know, I can say being here at Tulane, you know, our music collections, the flooding wasn't too selective there.
Uh-huh.
And in our Louisiana research collections, there were a few items actually stored in the basement of Jones Hall, and so some collections were damaged. And Lee Miller, who's the manuscripts curator for that collection, is always saying, you know, if the flooding could have been a little bit more selective, destroyed the collections that we really don't want and spared the ones that we really do want, you know, that would be really nice. But unfortunately, I mean, our problem for our cultural collections and cultural archives like we get with music is that a lot of archival theory is based on a business model developed in, you know, the 20s through 40s and 50s, and it didn't really change much, and we were really slow to jump on the postmodernist bandwagon. We didn't really pick it up until the late 90s, and we're still trying to sort it out, frankly, as far as I'm concerned. But anyways, anything else?
So should we just keep everything?
That's what the argument has been, you know, as to
who's going to archive you.
You're so young to be someone who seems to have had problems going into archives and finding that what you want has already been destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
Every researcher has had that happen to them, of course.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is that it's something which the head of the BBC Sound Archive, back in 1975, he was retired, Timothy Eckersley, he was retiring the following year. He was so proud that they selected only 10 hours of recordings a week to put into the BBC archive, so they would remain a manageable size. And of course, we all knew, even at that time, that it was the wrong 10 hours that Timothy Eckersley always chose. Because the important things, the early Goon shows, for example, those are not things that they would deem important to put into the sound, into their sound archive. You go up to Canada, the first thing that they'll ask you if you collect radio broadcasts, do you have a Lorne Greene newscast?
Mm-hmm.
They have all sorts of things that are, you know, that are either common or not that important. And something that was so important to Canada in World War II, nobody bothered to up in Canada to say they've not been able to find a Lorne Greene newscast. Mm-hmm. And selection is important. And the users are sometimes the ones who are more knowledgeable about what should be saying than the librarians and the archivists are, because we're the ones that have been thinking of what the research, what our research projects are going to be.
We had a couple questions, but I saw her hand up first and then first time.
I mean, I'm still only a student, but I know that selection is a big issue. Mm-hmm. But don't many archives nowadays find a home for the things they can't keep or they don't have a use for their collection, and there's always another collection that does have a use for those items, so that way they're not going away. So things are changing.
Yeah, I can't speak for all of the archivists out there. One would hope that that would be the general rule. And you do see a lot of activity on sort of listserv saying, hey, this is free to a good home. So it does happen, but I can't say if that happens all the time with everything, unfortunately.
So many of us find ourselves dumpster diving behind archives and libraries mm-hmm. and radio stations.
Oh, come on, Mike, when was the last time you were in a dumpster?
Last week!
Young women, whoever, we all have a history with things. And I don't know of any archive or library that's having big bonfires behind, you know, their library to destroy things. What they're doing is sending out a listserv. We can't collect everything. Not even Library of Congress, whatever the World Library of the world is going to collect everything. We have to be selective, etc., based on your you know, policies, and then go, hey, this person in Oklahoma would love, you know, Leon Russell, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know, you know, where this idea, and
I can give you countless examples.
I don't want to get into us versus them. We're all users. We're all, I think, very passionate about these materials and the idea that we're lighting matches and making these moral judgments. It's just wrong.
I can give you specific examples. You can say it is true.
It is not
a myth. It is true. It happens. Things are tossed indiscriminately in some cases.
Right. And some things go into book sales, if that's what you mean by tossing them.
No. What I mean is out in the dumpster. A library's entire film collection being put into the dumpster.
I haven't been in the professional field all that long, all of 2 years. And I can say I've seen examples of both, oddly enough, in all my short 2 years. So I'm not even going to...
I've seen collectors throw their stuff out. So,
yeah,
you know,
I think it's a little bit of both. And I think this is one of the difficult things with this issue is, in my mind, this would be the ideal, pursuing, you know, everything that we're supposed to do, plus everything else. But I haven't come up with the perfect solution of how to manage all of that data and material information.
Alas, I
think Vickers Building Number 8 was dynamited with the metal masters in it for the 16 inches.
Yeah. You have a question as well.
I do have a question. It doesn't have to do with burning anything.
Burning question.
Right. I was just wondering, I feel like activists, archiving and sort of activist selection, at some point, and I don't know if you've seen this sort of in the literature yet, we'll have to reckon with an idea of, so you talk about sort of community archives, so whether it's a cultural group or an ethnic group or you know, any number of kind of organizations or groups. At some point, a good thing that usually happens in society is that those outside groups stop being outside groups. And so I wonder what your opinion is on the sort of end game. Because I feel like, say you are school in Canada, so if you're an African-Canadian group or a Japanese-Canadian group, and those cultures were very outside at some point in collective thinking themselves, and at some point become fairly integrated, I guess this question arises of, do you then give your collection to a national institution that represents what is now your broader community, or does it stay separate to stay sort of activist?
I think when it reaches that part of being normalized within society, it's less a matter of labels as it is just what is institutional policy. Is that still
a valid policy or does it need to be revised? And who has space for it? Space and staff and money to maintain it. I think it might come down to those questions and a whole bunch of other questions as well. Would be my guess, at least.
Space is a big problem.
Yeah, space is a big problem for everyone.
Space costs. Any more questions?
Yeah. I wanted to thank you and say that what's interesting too about these sorts of policy decisions and inclusion and exclusion decisions, I'm coming at archives from an ethnomusicological and historical standpoint, more as a user than as an archivist. And what's striking to me in many cases is how historically meaningful some of those decisions can be in evaluating a collection by in terms of establishing what a particular institution or on a broader level what a particular community or culture, how they define what is included in the category and excluded from the category. And I find that especially so in private collections when dealing with individuals and figuring out how they organize their materials and their mind and what they thought about.
As a researcher who goes to the archives to deal with primary collections, so you're like the last person to go through and interpret meaning out of these things, because before you was the archivist, before that was the collector, and before that was the records creator. So there are all sorts of different levels of inclusions and exclusions and interpretations and meanings.
Gatekeepers.
So, yeah, well, I hate using that word still. But there are a lot of different layers there that I think researchers need to be more aware of, and whenever I can, like in this moment, I always advocate history students in any field of history to actually take an archives methodology course, just so they understand what happened before they got to this document.
I think in a contrary argument, what Foucault is saying is, and if you look at this room and at this conference, a lot of what drives what's going into archives, and I think what is driven on probably what a lot of people in this room do, debating an archivist, is supporting the margins and finding a place for the materials that wouldn't otherwise be part of the mainstream history, and ensuring that it survives into the future so that at some point it will find its rightful place in history as a voice against the so-called mainstream truth.
I think that is true. All of us are here, and a lot of us are going into sort of the more narrow areas. But a really good example, if you want to see a really enjoyable expression of constructed history or constructed society, I highly recommend that you read Umberto Eco's book, Mysterious Flame of Queen Leona, I think is how you pronounce it. It is very cool, all about somebody who had evidently amnesia from a series of heart attacks or strokes, and he tried to remember his childhood by going back to all of these Mussolini posters and stuff. Like, all this publicity that's around when he was a child, and he's trying to figure out what was he like as a child and what were his beliefs by looking at all of these publications and whatnot. It's very interesting when you look at constructions of society and culture. And it's fun. With pictures.
I think we'll very good Q&A, but I think it's time to maybe call it a night, or an evening or afternoon. We had three very engaging presentations and presenters. A nice round of applause for this.